December 10th, 1971, Chrysler Arena in Ann Arbor. John Lennon steps up to the microphone.
It ain't fair, John Sinclair, in the step of breathing hell. Won't you care for John Sinclair, in the step of breathing hell? Let him be, set him free, let him be like you and me.
That's the sound of John Lennon slamming the door on his Beatles days and embracing activism, embracing revolution. It's a story told by my next guest, James Mitchell, in his new book, The Walrus and the Elephants, John Lennon's Years of Revolution. James Mitchell, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
A fascinating book, and we're going to talk a lot about the big Free John Sinclair rally that was held in Ann Arbor. It was December 1971. But before we do that, if you could, take us to what compelled John Lennon to turn his back and walk away from his Beatle lifestyle and all its trappings in England and move to New York in 1971.
You know, I came to the conclusion it was a sincere, sometimes naive, and some people might say misguided, but you cannot argue. It was a sincere desire to change the way celebrity was perceived and used. And it started early. It looked odd and weird to have the press in your honeymoon bedroom, but when you just listen in hindsight, when he's saying, look, all the photographers, you're following me around, you're putting me in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't showboating. You're following us, so why not say peace? And when he took the billboard out, John Sinclair, Detroit's own, made a great observation in the book. He said, how many people took out billboards for an idea? Maybe for their new movie, new record, but for an idea? And he had felt that pressure. You know, a generation looked to the Beatles, and he said, well, let's be part of it.
And this was, when you think of the four Beatles, John was the art student. John was the toughest, probably, of the four to fit into that hole. He was almost sometimes that square peg in that round hole of Beatledom. and you could just listen to the quote Lennon/McCartney tunes, and it's quite easy to see what John wrote and what Paul wrote. So he always probably was chafing as that Beatle train was rolling on at who he had to be.
A little. And, you know, it's silly in hindsight. It's impossible to become more famous than they were at the time.
Yeah.
And only a few people have ever become anywhere close. And yes, his departure was so complete to move, to sell an estate in England, move to effectively a two-room apartment in Lower Manhattan, not a doorman building, not whatever, was unheard of. And his desire to simply be able to, as if he were back in art school, to hang out in Washington Square Park with the musicians and just play.
And I'm sure we cannot discount Yoko's role in opening his eyes to this.
Absolutely. And however
you feel,
vilified, et cetera, et cetera.
I think the years have softened that, don't you?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
She was from a different background, but also she had lived in New York. Now, if Lennon had decided to joined the movement in England, what there was of it, he knew people. He had gotten to know Tariq Ali, who I spoke with for the book. But in New York, he was new, and Yoko knew Andy Warhol scene, much of the Village Players, the political, and was the one who said, perhaps you should talk to Jerry Rubin, which may have been dubious in hindsight, but and with Rubin and Hoffman, which can get into later, you know, Lennon was open to all ideas, but he was equally quick to say, not my cup of tea, if it went too far.
Okay. Well, so here he had been wrestling with the very nature of being a pop star, just as he had his standing in the revolutionary world. So he had been at a point where he was trying to figure where to go. And then by 71, when he moved to New York, he was starting to gel on the side of activism.
Power to the people. Power to the people.
Power to the People was released in March 1971 with the Plastic Ono Band. And it really did come at a time when he realized that his post-Beatles life was going to include a more active role in the movement. What unlocked that? You said he met Jerry Rubin, and that Chicago 7 movement was kind of running out of steam. You quote Rennie Davis saying the steam ran out. You couldn't get anybody to do anything. So it sounds like you had a movement in need of a catalyst and a catalyst who needed a movement.
At the right time. You know, it's interesting because we're talking about a rock star, but he was more than that, clearly, and perceived as such by both sides. And the buildup to when he moved in, you go from the release of the Pentagon Papers in 69, I believe, Kent State, which reactivated the anti-war movement, but it stalled because the war was not slowing down. And there was almost an acceptance, and it was time to do something. The opposition of the war grew enough. Lenin just sincerely felt, you know, this is sort of silly. Millions of dollars, you know, there's got to be more to it than this. And he was always seeking more, quick to understand and admit if it didn't work.
I'm talking with Jim Mitchell, a Michigan-based author whose book, The Walrus and the Elephants, John Lennon's Years of Revolution, looks at Lennon as he closed the door on his Beatles days and then embraced activism, embraced revolution. And Ann Arbor in 1971 really became the perfect launch pad for Lennon's new life as a revolutionary. So take us there. And for those listeners who are not baby boomers who need a history lesson, who was John Sinclair and why did John Sinclair need freeing?
Well, John Sinclair was very well known in Ann Arbor and Detroit, poet, activist, along with, you know, quite a crowd. And in fact, Rennie Davis, one of the Chicago Seven, came out of Ann Arbor, as did the Students for a Democratic Society.
Tom Hayden had been a student here. Yeah, Port Huron's Tom Hayden, yes.
And so when Lennon by chance met Jerry Rubin, one of the seven defendants, along with Abby Hoffman in New York, there had been calls. John Sinclair was busted for possession of pot. It was his third arrest. At the time, even simple possession, two joints in this case, was a felony. And he was sentenced to 10 years right down the road in Jackson. A little stiff.
A little stiff. When you think of the climate today.
Well, I also think of two Detroit police officers who had that much time to spend in 1968.
Tracking down a guy with two joints.
A guy with a couple of joints.
And when you read the book, when you read Jim's book, you really do get a sense this police action would be called entrapment today. But back in 1967, it was a campus dope raid.
Yes, absolutely.
So there he was. He was in
prison.
Jackson. Yeah.
Not much had happened except shortly before Lennon came to America, the voting age was lowered to 18. And again, at the time, the generational divide was so strong that suddenly an entire nation's worth of politicians, up to and including the president, had to cater to this group.
I was among that group. Yeah.
And so rather than doing what youth really wanted most and the war, they said, let's soften the pot laws a little bit. And that became you saw it across the country.
Yes.
It began building just to decriminalize. The timing was amazing because Lennon's case had been low profile. Sinclair's case had been. When Lennon came here, suddenly the Lansing City Council, the Ann Arbor mayor appeared on stage or had a message read all behind it.
Because the idea was, let's have this big rally. And they were stunned when John Lennon said, okay, yep, I'll come to Ann Arbor and I'll play at Chrysler Arena. And tickets were $3, which meant there was no problem getting butts in seats. To see a Beatle for $3 was pretty good. And I'm suspecting the only time John Lennon had been in the Detroit area had been the Beatles' Olympia performances, which were 64. I don't think they came back again. I remember that because I didn't get to go to the 64, and I never forgave my mother for that.
I think they did two.
Maybe
I
they
think
did.
They did Olympia.
At Olympia. They were at Olympia. So here he comes, and John and Yoko come in, picked up at the airport by concert promoter Peter Andrews, taken to the presidential suite at the Campus Inn. And it does get this – I get the strong sense from your book that Andrews couldn't quite believe that he had scored John Lennon for this John Sinclair rally.
Oh, absolutely. When they first approached him, you know, Phil Chrysler Arena, and they had – well, Bob Seger couldn't fill Chrysler in 71. God bless him. He was still
on the way up.
Hero.
Yeah.
You know, and they didn't have much, and Chrysler's huge. Yeah. But then Lennon out of the blue, and that was his custom, by the, his attitude in New York. So he joined in.
Said, okay. Some more people started to jump on board.
Sure.
You have a great story in the book that I'd like, Jim, to have you tell us. So the rally is happening, and Motown Stevie Wonder decided, I'm going to perform. Talk to us about Lennon's reaction when he realized that Stevie Wonder was on the stage.
Right. Lennon was backstage, and Peter Andrews had told me this story. Waiting him, when he heard Stevie Wonder start, his eyes lit up like he was the fan, and he had to see, you know. And Andrews said to him, well, I can't walk a Beatle around the crowd. And apparently Lennon said, hey, Stevie Wonder is my Beatles.
Wow.
I got to see him. So they brought him out for a few minutes by the side, but pretty soon it got a little...
The buzz was growing.
Had to have. Hard to imagine, but through the haze of what was likely a cloud of pot smoke that dominated the arena, you know, he just enjoyed music.
So John Lennon and Yoko perform, and they did, what, four songs in their set?
Just four songs. They were so resistant of playing Beatle hits for a while. But he also wanted it to be the song about John Sinclair, these songs about, you know, get involved, get active.
Give him 10 for 2. What else can the bastards do? We got to set him free. Free.
And it worked because... with all the timing, all of the things coming together, Lennon's visibility. 2 days later, they release Sinclair.
After he sings Let Him Be, Set Him Free, they did.
And that caught the attention of the undercover agents who were so disguised in the audience, even Stevie Wonder knew they were out there. Because he gave him a shout-out from the stage. And you have to think of the context of the times for a performer to say, and this also goes out to any undercover agents who might happen to be with us tonight.
Here, it was really the launching of an interesting 9 years, because it was 9 years less 2 days after that rally at Chrysler Arena that John Lennon was gunned down in front of the Dakota by Mark David Chapman. How do you think, Jim, that those 9 years of Lennon's activism that really were launched in Ann Arbor, how did they leave their mark?
Not that many. It was such a short period. Mm-hmm. And what happened after the John Sinclair concert, some of the Chicago Seven and Sinclair, they were serious. They were going to have a political tour that would follow the 72 Republican tour and rally the youth vote. And what happened in Washington was somebody was heard to say they thought he could sway the election, quote unquote. And that's why they began the deportation hearings. Hindsight kind of nutshells it that the government wanted to kick him out because they didn't like his opinions, which would be obviously wrong.
Mm.
It was worse than that with Nixon. It was paranoia over the election.
So he was a political enemy in Richard Nixon's eyes.
Absolutely. And the pressure built. Lennon backed off the tour largely because Jerry Rubin was not his own best spokesman. Mm. And he began to realize these guys were a little on the far side of it. But to say that he backed off the movement under the green card things is totally false. During that year, and a lot of it had gone underreported, I think, a little.
Mm-hmm.
One day he would be at a INS hearing, and the next standing on stage at a rally for something, whether to protest the Bloody Sunday riots in Ireland.
Attica.
Attica.
Yeah.
You know, and jumping in with both feet. The problem is that even after the investigation stalled when Nixon won, it was still in a bureaucratic mess, and it took a few years to straighten out until he finally took the offensive. His activism veered. There was little – he was restricted in performing and working, but they didn't want to leave because of the search for Yoko's daughter and many other details. And in 75, after his son was born, he did retire for the last 5 years.
He was a house husband.
Yeah, he absolutely was, and that wasn't cool back then. We still thought he was weird back then, and now it was, wow, an open guy.
And here he was relaunching with Double Fantasy when he was killed.
And still believing he could walk around New York, and every time he saw fans step out to chat. He didn't travel
with a posse.
Bodyguards, with this and that.
What most surprised you about this man, John Lennon, as you dug into his work and his life in this time?
That he was sincere and yet not as arrogant as people might have assumed. And I think he understood that things looked silly. And some of the things they did, certainly with Yoko's influence of avant-garde art or bagism and some of these conceptual type things. When I had a chance, when I reviewed it all within the context of those couple years and would watch him on a YouTube clip explaining it, he's laughing as well. He understands. You know, it may not be everyone's cup of tea, but he just believed in free expression. I believe he was sincere. No saint, no angel, not perfect. However, to have responded to the level of fame the way he did, the way all the Beatles did, in hindsight and perspective is pretty admirable. But generally sincere and consistent on issues. And by the end of the day, Lennon, as well as everyone else who fought the fight, history shows if they were for minority rights, if they were for feminists, history shows them on the right side of the issue. His problem with Rubin and Hoffman and some, they were just against a thing, a person, and rallying against.
As opposed to a for.
For. I mean, John Kerry bumped into Lennon when he was leading the Vietnam veterans against the war. Peaceful protest, let's talk about it. And we know where he is today. Yeah. I couldn't get in touch with him for this. One of the interviews that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. And it's an absolutely fascinating history lesson as you look back at that time. And thank you so much for sharing your stories with us today.
Thank you.
James Mitchell, and the book again is The Walrus and the Elephants, John Lennon's Years of Revolution.
You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we don't love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all doing what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait.